Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Today, I want to talk about something fundamental to our well-being and something we might not think about every day, our bones. They're the silent architects of our bodies, providing structure, support, and allowing us to move and groove. But just like any foundation, our bones need care and attention to stay strong and healthy throughout our lives. And there are many factors in our everyday life which can threaten our bones. So you might be wondering, well, is my bone health something I do need to worry about? Well, here it depends on your history, your heredity, and your age. So here are some important clues we can look at. First of all, what's the story in your family? Has anyone in your close family experienced a fracture after the age of 50 from a minor fall? Has anyone developed a serious forward lean as they leaned into their 70s and 80s? This family history can definitely give us a heads up that there might be trouble ahead for you. Thinking about your personal health, have there been any challenges with eating disorders like bulimia or anorexia? Or perhaps a history of intense physical training in sports like competitive gymnastics or ballet? These can sometimes adversely impact bone development, especially in younger years. Anytime a menstruating woman stops menstruating in her teens and 20s, she stops building strength in her bones and may actually lose structural strength. Also, have there been any major changes to your digestive system, like gastric bypass surgery? A lot of very specific vitamin deficiencies occur in people who've had those surgeries. And often for a few years, they're very good about following up and taking their vitamins. And then they kind of slide off, and perhaps their doctors aren't really alert to continuing to reinforce. But if you've had one of those surgeries, you have a lifelong need for high levels of certain supplements by B12, or you're going to develop all kinds of long-term health problems, some of which are painful and very much to be avoided. What about a history of long-term use of proton pump inhibitors? It's over-the-counter. Drugs like omeprazole, they seem so harmless, taking them for heartburn. But some people start taking them every day for years. And these drugs affect also, just like the gastric surgery, how our bodies absorb nutrients like calcium and magnesium that are important for bone health. Moving on to hormones, have you experienced an overactive thyroid? Or are you taking a medication for underactive thyroid? Are you taking the right dose for your hypothyroidism? I find a lot of people are taking a little bit too much. Maybe their biological need drops. I like to check annually to make sure people aren't overdosing, because if you take too much thyroid, you will cause problems with your bones. You will cause yourself to have calcium loss. Also, what about other health conditions? Celiac disease, which is an autoimmune condition triggered by some compounds that are found in wheat, and also inflammatory bowel disease, where the inflamed gut simply isn't able to properly absorb the nutrients. These conditions can also interfere with nutrient absorption. For some individuals, gender reassignment can also have implications for bone health. And think about medications, too. Have you used inhaled steroids for asthma long-term? Have you had to take oral steroids for asthma exacerbations or other chronic steroids, perhaps for conditions like cancer chemotherapy? Steroids can definitely impact bone density. For those who've had children, did you breastfeed after the pregnancy? This can make a big difference, because with breastfeeding, women actually are able to rebuild their bones. The calcium gets leached from your bones when you're making a baby. There used to be, in olden times, a saying, you lose a tooth for every child. And the idea there was that that's one of the places that the body could grab calcium to baby build would be your jaw. Breastfeeding prolongs the ability of your bones to recover their calcium and add calcium back in. This doesn't happen ordinarily in the life of an adult woman. Finally, for women, what's the menstrual history? Did periods start later than age 14? Or did menopause arrive early before age 45, whether naturally, surgically, or due to chemotherapy? Estrogen plays a vital role in maintaining bone strengths. So how do doctors actually check up on our bones? Well, the gold standard is a test called a DEXA scan. This stands for Dual Energy X-ray Absorptiometry. It's a special kind of low radiation X-ray that uses two different frequencies and uses the difference in the way the bone absorbs these two different frequencies to measure density. Now, there's some caveats with this type of testing. First of all, density doesn't always equal strength. For a while, we were giving women boron, particularly a type of boron called boron ranulate. Well, this is going back maybe 10 years. But studies came out of Europe that suggested that this really improved bone density. It did. The problem is that the boron fooled the bone scan and made the bones look more dense, but they didn't get stronger. And so as a result, there was no reduction in the fracture risk, even though the test was normal, the bones were not. It's important that the test be done on the same type of machine, because different machines can have variations in readings. And even if you get the same test on the same machine just moments apart, there could be a small natural variation of about 1 or 2% in your two scores. And 1 or 2% change in a T-score is considered significant. So bone health changes are usually assessed over longer periods, a couple of years at the most. And there's a big controversy right now about whether women should get a baseline bone density. In my opinion, if they have any of these risk factors that we've just gone over, a baseline bone density when the periods start to get weird, and that could be 2 or 3 years in the perimenopause date. But that's basically when a woman is close to her maximum bone density. So seeing where you are on your maximum, seeing if you have more bone than the average 35-year-old woman or less bone than the average 35-year-old woman can make a big difference. Now, we have these things called T-score and Z-score. A T-score compares your bone density to that of a healthy young adult, 35-year-old woman or man of the same sex. It's used to diagnose osteoporosis and assess fracture risk in older adults. The Z-score compares your bone density to that of other people of the same age, sex, race, height, and weight. So it's more useful for younger individuals, but it's also, I think, very comforting for older individuals to discover that while their T-score might be minus 1.5, they're 80 years old and their Z-score is plus 1.5. So you don't get quite as worried about that. The T-score really doesn't tell the whole story. What you really want is to do something called a FRAX risk score. And the University of Sheffield in England put together this tool that takes into account your bone density, your age, your smoking history, your alcohol history, a whole bunch of other factors, including your history of steroid use, to really kind of handicap you for your absolute fracture risk. So it's much more has a better predictive value than the T-score for given individuals. And if the calculated risk of a fracture is greater than 20%, then the United States recommends that we should take drugs. The other countries use a higher level of fracture risk. I tend to think that the most important thing is to understand that this FRAX score plus family history gives you the best thing. If you know that your mother and your aunts and your grandmothers never broke anything, and they had low T scores. What they have is good microstructure, and that tends to be hereditary. We'll often see people with darker skins have better microstructure of their bones. People with lighter skins, basically Caucasians and Asians, tend to have a thinner microstructure to their bones. So, and the DEXA scores really work for them quite accurately. They aren't so predictive in people of color, probably because of structural differences, literally bone deep. Now, regardless of whether medications are recommended based on your score, there's so many things all of us can do to nurture our bone health. And most of these things also are useful for your risk for cancer and some of them even for cardiovascular disease. So let's move on to what you can do to have healthier bones. First, move your body. Think about activities that put a little stress on your bones. Unfortunately, swimming really doesn't. But walking, jumping, and even exercising on a vibration plate can stimulate bone cells to make more bone. Our bones respond to the forces we put on them. When we squeeze our bones, when we compress them in a gravity field, we actually set up an electrical signal that signals to the bone-building cells, the osteoblasts, to lay down bone matrix, to make more bone, to mineralize that bone. This happens all the time because our bones are constantly fatiguing and getting microfractures, which are, you know, non-painful, but they weaken the bone. So we are constantly in a state of bone turnover, breaking down bone in one spot, recycling the protein and the calcium and building bone in another spot. So movement. Number two, nourish your bones with the right vitamin. Vitamin D is crucial because it helps our bodies absorb calcium from our diet. Vitamin K2 plays a role in directing that calcium into our bones and keeping it in our arteries. When you want to take adequate vitamin D, either dietarily or sunlight or supplements, my recommendation is that you get a vitamin D level in the winter and make sure that it is above 40. And that is nanograms per milliliter. And what that will do is that will give you a good enough vitamin D level for absorption, even if you have a variation in your vitamin D receptor, which, since I do genetics on a lot of my patients, I can tell you many people do. When it comes to dietary calcium, remember, our gut can only absorb about 400 milligrams at a time. So it's better to spread your calcium intake throughout the day if you're going to take supplements. And some calciums don't dissolve well in the gut, so it's very important that we take those into consideration. And we watch that we get those calciums, that we split it up, and that the calcium that we take will dissolve in a glass of vinegar overnight. If it won't, it may not dissolve in you unless you chew it up. I also recommend supplementing with equal ratios of calcium and magnesium, as magnesium is also important for bone health. And let's see, that's one. So we'll go ahead and click that. The next thing is dosing on the vitamin D and the vitamin K2 before I continue. So vitamin D, 4,000 to 5,000 units a day is fine for most people. And again, as I say, checking annual levels in the winter. If I don't like people taking 50,000 units of vitamin D a week, I think that that probably is self-defeating and does not correspond to what the physiology is expecting and may actually have a damping effect on some of the benefits of vitamin D, because it's not just about calcium. Vitamin D is important for modulating the immune system. Low levels of vitamin D are associated with increased risks of multiple sclerosis in military recruits. That's data that goes back literally 40 years. Vitamin K comes in several flavors. The best flavor for directing the calcium into your bones is vitamin K2, and then MK7, 8, and 9. Those are the molecules that do the best job, and you can get plenty of vitamin K from our next thing, but you have to have a good microbiome to actually extract it. And that's your greens. Green vegetables, especially when combined with a little acid like lemon juice, can actually, which can improve the calcium absorption. Think of salads with vinegar. You could also have oil. But greens are a really excellent dietary source of calcium. And of course, milk and dairy products are very good from a calcium standpoint, but carry some baggage from the standpoint of organic pollutants and saturated fats. So let's talk about estrogen, because that's a complex question. But for women, estrogen plays a significant role in maintaining bone density. Let's talk about what's going on there. You have cells that break down bone. These are called osteoclasts. And they literally are like little tiny Pac-Men. And the bone, you can think of that as sort of having a branching structure like a really dense bush. And they chew away at the stems of the bush and enlarge the spaces between the branches. And then the other cells, the osteoblasts, I remember this by B is for building bones, go and lay down the osteocalcin, which is the bone matrix, which then gets mineralized. So you want to have a good balance between the osteoclasts and the osteoblasts. And the osteoclasts are necessary. You want to break down that bone that has microfractures and is becoming brittle, but then you want to build it back up again to the same place it was before, hopefully at that level of that mythical 35-year-old average person. There are hormone therapy is a complex topic, but I believe that the risks of hormone therapy, particularly when you're doing bioidentical hormone therapy and you know what you're doing as a physician, are very minimal, and the benefits are very outweigh any risks. There are also drugs that stimulate the bone estrogen receptors, but do not stimulate the estrogen receptors in your breasts. And tamoxifen is actually used for breast cancer. Its first cousin, raloxifen, is FDA approved for the prevention of osteoporosis. Let's see. We can get through the pharmaceuticals. So we mentioned estrogen and SERMs already. There are also a whole class of drugs called the bisphosphonates, Fosamax, and these essentially cross-link the old bone. They make it harder for the osteoclasts to break it down. So you can, yeah, I mentioned, you know, imagine like little caterpillars eating the branches on a dense bush. Well, what if you were to lacquer the bush, you know, so that it was somewhat solidified, it would be harder for the poor little caterpillars to chew it up. And that's exactly what happens. There is some controversy about whether it's actually toxic to the osteoclasts. But what we do see with the bisphosphonates is that they slow down that bone recycling. And so that means that the bones can get a little funky. Now, the good news is that bisphosphonates prevent hip fractures and spinal fractures. The bad news is that rarely, this is more common in Asian women than any other group, they will get an odd fracture that doesn't normally happen to people, which is a mid-shaft femur fracture. And that's from essentially bone fatigue not being broken down and replaced with fresh bone. And if you think about horses, one of the things that happens with these, you know, thoroughbred race horses that are, you know, running at these breakneck speeds is that they break their femur. There's a place on the femur which is subject to the most stress. And oddly enough, it's not the hip, it's the mid-shaft. And so we think that those mid-shaft femur fractures, almost unheard of in in under normal circumstances, have increased. They're still rare, and I still think that it can be very appropriate to use bisphosphonates in spite of this, you know, admittedly rare side effect. There's also a new type of medication, and wouldn't you know it, it's a monoclonal antibody, denosumab, also known as Prolia. It's given by injection once or twice a year, and these are antibodies that inhibit a compound called RANKL, R-A-N-K-L, no idea what it stands for, don't want to know. But anyway, these RANKL inhibitors essentially slow down the osteoclasts. It's like giving them a tranquilizer. So they still break down bone, but they do it more slowly. So that allows the osteoblasts to catch up on the bone building that they've fallen behind on. Estrogen, by the way, directly stimulates the osteoblasts. And we do have one other drug that'll do that. It's called Forteo. It's a parathyroid hormone analog. Now, this is crazy because parathyroid hormone actually takes calcium out of your bones. You have two hormones. One's called calcitonin, which is, works with vitamin K to put calcium into your bones. The other one, parathyroid, takes calcium out of your bones. And you're always moving calcium around because your kidneys need it to balance your blood pH. And it's very important that calcium in the bloodstream calcium inside the cells stay in a good place. So if the cells are getting hungry for calcium, and that's not just the bone cells, all of your body cells need it, the kidneys will recognize that and suck calcium from the bones. Parathyroid hormone is how they do it. But too much parathyroid hormone from a hormone-producing tumor can also lead to osteoporosis. But this is where it gets weird. You can take a chemical analog of that same parathyroid hormone, a thing that normally takes calcium out of bones, and if you give a pulse, like a massive overdose of it, far more than is ordinarily produced, what you get is stimulation of the formation of new bone, exactly the opposite of what you would expect. But yeah, that's the human body for you. It never does respond to logic. So remember, we have a significant power to influence the strength and health of our bones throughout our lives by incorporating movement, a balanced diet rich in calcium and essential vitamins, and being mindful of our overall health. We can all work towards building and maintaining a strong skeletal foundation for years to come. You got to play the long game, and every step we take towards bone health is a worthwhile investment in our future well-being. We have a caller. Hello, what's your name, and where are you calling from?
My name is CJ. I'm calling from Santa Cruz.
Well, hello, CJ.
And hi, I'm a longtime listener, and I was driving home and heard the bit about boron renalate.
Mm-hmm.
And I am a cancer survivor. I am on Arimidex. I worked with an oncological nutritionist who suggested using strontium citrate and Ipraflavone. I have regular bone scans, bone density scans. My primary care physician is concerned about the very thing you mentioned, which is it could make the bones denser but not stronger. And everything my nutritionist has sent to me in articles said that was primarily with the renalate and not with this form that I'm taking.
Strontium and boron renalate are really different. And
okay.
I was just looking at the Ipraflavone because it wasn't really ringing a bell for me. Oh, okay. Now it's just a trade name. It's Daidzen, which is a soy isoflavone. So it has some estrogen receptor stimulating properties. And so it can help with stimulating those osteoblasts. So I don't know how strong the data for it is, but there's certainly no reason not to give it a shot. So I don't think the strontium does anything in terms of fooling the DEXA. And that's sort of your question.
That's the question, yeah.
Yeah.
We just revisited it, and I went back through the literature, and So now I can go back to my primary care and say, I think we're good. I think we're good because my bone density is showing up as very good.
Yes, that is good. And the other thing that you can do just to backstop that is ask your doctor to get either a C or a N-telopeptide. Telopeptide is that protein that I was mentioning briefly that gets broken down and then recycled. And so if you're building bone and breaking it down at about the same rate, your level should be in the normal range for premenopausal women. And if you're breaking down bone more quickly, you'll be above that mark. So the higher that you have, the higher residual protein that's showing up in your urine, the less happy I am with your bone balance. So that could be a way of just, you know, kind of fact checking it, because if that number if that number is high, then you are looking at a mirage on the bone scan.
And what was that again? Can you say it more slowly?
Yeah, it's I'll spell it. So it's C hyphen or N hyphen. N hyphen is urine and C hyphen is blood. And then it's T-E-L-O-P-E-P-T-I-D-E. Telopeptide.
Okay. I will follow up with that because I would like to be doubly sure I'm not shooting myself in the foot here.
No shooting in feet. Bad idea.
Nothing at all.
I was out hunting with my father once, and we had this, let's just say, a testosterone-addled teenage boy. And he did. He was like trying to whirl the gun on his finger. And he did almost shoot himself in the foot. And it was like,
okay.
Yeah, my dad and I looked at each other, and then we looked at the friend who'd brought the kid, and we're like,
we're not going hunting with him again.
No, it was like, okay, that's that.
All right, Dr. Dawn, thanks so much for your show and for this information. I'll follow up with her.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
You know, here's a little something for the guys. An implantable non-hormonal male contraceptive has been shown in trials to last for at least 2 years. The contraceptive, known as Atom, is a water-soluble hydrogel that is implanted in the sperm ducts, preventing sperm from mixing with semen. The company behind the product, Contraline, says the approach offers a reasonable alternative to condoms and vasectomies, with the hydrogel designed to break down in the body after a set period of time, restoring fertility. So the phase one clinical trial has happened, and it showed that Atom can successfully block the release of sperm for 24 months, with no sperm detected in the semen of the two participants who have so far reached this time point in the trial. In addition, there's been no serious adverse events. Of course, this is a small trial of 25 participants who've been enrolled over time, but it is proof of concept and also 25 procedures without any adverse effects is pretty good, especially since you'd expect bruising, and there hasn't been any. It's done under local anesthesia, and the vas deferens is actually pretty easy to find. I've done my share of vasectomies over the years. And once you find it, you're just basically taking a little insulin syringe, having already numbed up the skin, and doing a little injection of a controlled amount. It's not the first male contraceptive that acts by blocking sperm ducts, but implants have previously been materials that do not break down in the body, and that such implants could cause scarring of the vas and lead to permanent sterilization, which was, unless you're intending that, you might as well just go for the vasectomy if you're intending permanent sterilization. This predictable lifespan of the hydrogel, of course, will need to be demonstrated to everyone's satisfaction before we want to rely on this. They're going to begin a phase two clinical trial in Australia involving 50 participants. And we need, of course, reliability data, but I think that it is a step in the right direction, and I'm excited to see where this goes. There's been a lot of talk lately, like the last 48 hours, about autism because of some remarks that were made by the Irrepressible Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And anyway, we're not going to go into those remarks, but it got everyone up in arms. I thought I might talk about autism because it shouldn't really be thought of as one thing. It's more formally called autism spectrum disorder. And it's characterized by difficulties in social skills, sometimes communication skills, sometimes repetitive behaviors, but there are probably as many different versions of autism as there are people who have it. There are, just like all of these DSM categories, a lot of checklists, and you have to have, you know, two from column three and one from column two. But there's such a wide spectrum of challenges that there's a saying in the autism community, if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. About 30% of people with autism have substantial intellectual disability, sometimes very limited language skills, and they may need a lifetime of care. On the other end, we see people who have unusual strengths, unique talents. Neurodiversity is not such a bad thing in a society. Intense focus on particular interests is something that tends to be a fairly common trait in the higher functioning individuals. Savant skills in math, computer science, music, art, special abilities, superpowers, if you will, that some autistic people have, and maybe differences in how they socialize. But is that necessarily a bad thing? Brian King, the vice chair for child and adolescent psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco, says, there's something very sincere and authentic about being able to see and say things that are unencumbered by social conventions. Now, what causes autism? We're born. Well, there's probably many things that are involved. This is a multifactorial thing. But the broadest definition of this is a different pruning pattern. Now, you've probably seen those bushes that are pruned into swans or bears or dinosaurs. And that's called topiary. Well, we are born with 10 times more neurons as children, as infants, than we have as adults. And the building of the adult brain is basically a form of neurological topiary. We prune, we do a hard prune on the synapses that don't get used. One of the things that we see in children who go on later to be diagnosed with autism is we see alterations in the neuroimaging of brain regions and circuitry, basically abnormal and different, abnormal and atypical, let's use that word as said, atypical pruning patterns. And these infants have accelerated brain growth of the cortex compared with siblings who are not autism, who don't have autism. We also see altered brain functioning, which you'd expect if the structure is different. And the consensus after 30 years of research is if you are autistic, you were born with it and you had it way before your measles shot. Genetics is a big deal here. It's 80 to 90% heritable. Twin studies have proven that. We also know that the intrauterine environment, if a person is pregnant, has chronic inflammation, there's some idea that the immune system of the mother isn't properly inactivated, and so there's some attack on the infant brain. But the vaccine hypothesis or scam has been thoroughly debunked. This is complex. Another fun fact about autism is that the microbiomes of children with autism are very, very different. Now, that makes sense because the vagus nerve from the brain goes to the gut, and the gut-brain axis is a two-way street. So probably the microbiome is significantly affected by this disease. Whether it is a cause or a result is for anybody to say. But preterm birth or a very low birth weight increases the risk about four times more. Is that because they're born early because of an inflammatory condition or some other factor that's also affecting the brain and later programming of pruning? birth complications, particularly oxygen deprivation at birth, increase the risk. And let's talk about classifications, because one of the things that's happened is that the classification and the method of diagnosing autism has changed drastically over the last 30 years. So because you're moving the goalpost, so to speak, on how to diagnose it, and comparing numbers from 30 years ago and saying it's more common, it may or may not be more common, because, for example, California has more than five times the prevalence of autism than Texas, but California also had an education campaign for autism awareness, as well as funding state benefits to support autism services. So there's an incentive to make that diagnosis in California that doesn't exist in Texas, and probably has a lot more to do with the difference in rates than the difference in vaccination does. More preterm babies are surviving. There are more older parents, and we know the age of the father is a factor here. So the point is, we have early childhood interventions. We have ways of addressing autism that we didn't even dream of 30 years ago. And we can affect that pruning. There's a saying in neurology, neurons that fire together, wire together. So intensive early childhood stimulation, social conditioning, and other things can make a big difference in whether that brain prunes in a direction that allows for an independent and productive and happy life. So we have a brief email. This from Mardine in Ben Lomond. Mardine writes, "Treatment for urinary incontinence. I heard about this supplement on the What Doctors Don't Tell You podcast, and I would like to hear your opinion about it. Are the ingredients helpful for treating urinary incontinence? Is it worth trying? Is it one of those can't hurt, might help kind of things? And I've seen a physical therapist and have been using a vaginal wand for several months, and it has improved my bladder control considerably, but I would like to throw the pads away for good. I'm considering Bulkamid or some other pharmaceutical treatments, but if something like this might help, I would try it first." Okay, so I went to this BeBetterNow.com website, and I immediately, I felt like a bunch of marketing fleas jumped on me. The screen lit up, and all kinds of little boxes had to be closed before I could read anything. The minute I touched it, I got another little box. What the product is, Better Woman, don't love the title. A proprietary blend, it's 400 milligrams, and it's a proprietary blend of about 30 different herbs. Most of these are Chinese herbs, although they're giving the Western names for them. I recognize them as part of the Chinese pharmacopoeia. So let's see, we've got another caller coming in. Maybe that's the person who we lost earlier. Hello, you're on the air. Okay, well.
All right.
Hi there. So what's your name again?
Yeah, no, I did not mean to be on the air.
Oh, you didn't. Okay, well, I'll take you off the air, but have a good day. Okay, well, I'm getting all confused here. Back to Mardine. So fleas jumping all over me, little marketing fleas. And as I said, about 30 different Chinese herbs. Given that it's 40 milligrams, these are very small amounts. The serving is one capsule twice a day. So right out of the box, while some of these herbs are used in Chinese formulas for strengthening the bladder and bladder control, the dose is too small to do anything. The dose is twice a day. And so the 40 capsules you get in a bottle is only a 20-day supply. They make a big deal that you must treat for 60 days. And so they will only sell you three bottles of capsules for a grand total of $164.96. And of course, you can get $5 off if you subscribe. So this is just blatant marketing ripoff. And if you are interested in trying Chinese herbs for control of your bladder, you can find these in a much more cost-effective way, and you can get probably the right doses by going to an Oriental medical doctor or an acupuncturist who also does Chinese herbs. And we're in Santa Cruz. We have a major acupuncture school here, Five Branches School of Oriental Medicine. You literally cannot throw you cannot throw a frisbee on the beach without hitting an acupuncturist in this town. So I'm giving it a two thumbs down, Mardine, in terms of not really thinking that's useful or something that you want to do. Okay, so this came from an anonymous emailer who gave their name as Fatty15. What is this compound, Fatty15 Pure C15 Pentadecanoic Acid Supplement? It's marketed as a supplement to support long-term health and wellness, with claims of promoting healthy metabolism, balancing immunity, and heart health. Sort of the full Monty, huh? Some users report near-term benefits like calmer mood, deeper sleep, and less snacking. So I went and looked up this stuff, the pentadecanoic acid, and found a mini review that was written, in October of 2024. I'm going to just quote the abstract. PDA is an odd and minor fatty acid that has been neglected in the literature until the last decade. Indeed, as a special fatty acid, PDA was only used as a biomarker of dairy fat consumption. Later, PDA was correlated first negatively with the incidence of metabolic syndrome disorder, and then its physiological effects have been investigated as a protective fatty acid. PDA supplementation has been demonstrated as negatively correlated with elevated levels of leptin, plasminogen activator inhibitor, and insulin, and has been shown to exhibit insulin-sensitivity effects, and also reduce the severity of metabolic dysfunction-associated steatohepatitis. All of this work has been done in rodents, and in rodent models that are just, well, let's just say a little far-fetched to say that it's going to have any kind of benefit in humans who are eating a standard American diet. So causality has not been demonstrated, only correlations. There is one study looking at this in young adults with overweight and obesity to see if it made a difference. What they found was that in a very small study, that the drug was absorbed orally and that there were decreases in the liver enzymes, which would make us think that the person would maybe be having a healthier liver. But it's thin, 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 and I think we have such enormous amount of data on the benefits of the omega-3 fatty acids that I wouldn't go off and start buying the fatty acid du jour with any kind of expectation that it's going to be a real game changer for you. Okay, we have time for a few quick ones while we're on the subject of obesity and metabolic syndrome. Let's talk about patients may soon get the benefits of Ozempic by a pill. There's a new drug in town, a GLP-1 pill called Orforglipron. Yeah, this one's a good one. They will have to come up with a catchy trade name for this, is all I can say. It appears to lower blood sugar and promote weight loss in diabetics as effectively as the popular injectables. This is a clinical trial. They had more than 500 people with diabetes who were given either Orforglipron or a placebo for 40 weeks. Those who received the medication saw their levels drop about the same amounts as Ozempic and Mounjaro did in similar studies. 65% saw their blood sugar levels get into the normal range, and they lost on the average 16 pounds, which is about the same as the Ozempic weight loss. The issue here is going to be liver damage, and a previous pill, similar idea that Pfizer came out with, had to be halted when signs of liver damage resulted. But if the results demonstrate stability and no lack of and no liver toxicity, this could be a real game changer. It doesn't have to be injected, and it can be taken orally. And I guess we'll have to wait and see. Brave New Plastics. This is actually a substantial move forward. Scientists have developed a plant-based material that could offer an environmentally friendly alternative to translucent plastic. It's a transparent paperboard. It's made from cellulose. Cellulose is the stuff that makes up the walls of plant cell. Cellulose is the thing we call fiber when we eat it. Cellulose is what my bunny ferments when she makes, when she eats my one of my textbooks that I've left on the table, and then turns it into little bunny turds. They can, bunnies can ferment cellulose, and of course, so can termites. And it's all about the microbiome. So cellulose is already used to make cellophane, but that's too flimsy for most applications. The team found the way to stiffen the material by treating it with lithium bromide. They can make a cup out of this resulting paperboard that can hold just boiled water for over 3 hours with minimal leakage. And it's also a source of healthy fiber. It's not only shapeable, but has the potential to serve as a sustainable alternative to conventional plastics. And plastics, as we all know, take centuries to break down, and they clog our oceans, and we all have plastic in our brains, and all the babies have plastic in their placenta now. The transparent paperboard degrades completely within 300 days in the ocean, and even more quickly in shallow water. It can be made not only from virgin cellulose, but from cellulose pulled from recycled materials, including discarded clothing. So this is a real significant benefit in terms of giving us an alternative to one of the more common uses of plastic bottles. And if we can make that work and change the supply chain, we are going to deal with the, we're going to take a step forward with the next potential environmental crisis. So I think that's a wrap. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.